party.
And he's fucking putting his jacket on, he's putting his sunglasses on, blah, blah. And you're doing a party. But I'm like, did he? He did, yeah. We were, the grass was this high. And there's the tour manager, Ali, me and Astro, like, going through all this like, hay and long grass marching to it. And he was baking hot and marching through it. And all you can hear in the background is and the audience is coming mental. But you can hear the, because we're so far away, you can hear the audience slowly getting quieter and quieter. So are they taking the piss? What?
The intro
was about 20 minutes long. It, for me, looking back on it and reflecting on it, it was an experience that changed my life forever. It's just, I think the thing is, at the time, I was angry, and I'm sure they were angry with me because I went out there and I was slagging them off, and they were slagging me off. That was 5 years ago, do you know what I mean? And you have to move on, otherwise, yeah. Like we were talking about this, now you go bonkers. It's all the same thing, you know, council tax, they threaten you with liability orders. You know, there hasn't been a liability order from council tax since 2003, they abolished them. So they threaten everybody with a liability order, but they don't even exist. So you go, oh, that's fraudulent. Anyway, what else we got? TV license, Jesus Christ, I'm paying that. So anyway, got down to rehearsal, and first day, the MD comes on, he said, well, Ali's due in about 1 o'clock, this is about 11. I said, let's go and have a listen, see how you've got on. It's got the little tape player. Tape players, remember? And I just went through each track, and he went, no, that's wrong. No, you have to change that one. Get away with, no, I mean, we'll have to do it. Every single one at the 25 went, we'll have to do it again. And Ali was due in 2 hours' time, do you know what I mean? But bang, in London, full of professional musicians, and I'm like, I mean, somebody had asked me now, I'd be like, nah, no thanks, because you never replace the lead singer, yeah. Because you're always classed as, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's no Marcy Pillow.
Exactly, even though you could be better, miles better, but you're still classed as, you know, it's not Marcy Pillow. Mm. It's the voice in it. That's a fire, God. It's a bit
noisy. Who came up with the name?
I come up with a name, but it's a bit naughty how it was put together. It's actually, the name is a cross-translation of two of my favourite reggae bands, because there's a band in New Zealand called House of Shem, and there's a band from Jamaica called Raging Fire. So I mixed the two together and called it House of Fire. But that's why they are. And the other band, I mean, like you said, it's like your second family, you know what I mean? And we were really close, all of us. Not one call did I get after I got fired. Not one from any of them. You know, one person, that was Pops, who was the guitarist. But I mean, even with Pops, he was heartbreaking, because just before I left, he was about 74, 75, Pops. So it's Winston DeLandro was his real name. But he was like my tour dad, you know what I mean? And he played with some serious, he played with Bob Marley, Johnny Nash. He was a legend himself. Nowadays, the music industry, with all, I think X Factor and all those kind of things, absolutely obliterated the industry, because you just get people who can stand in the bedroom and sing with an airbrush in front of the mirror and think they're world famous. And then they go on there, and because they can slightly sing in tune, they're accelerated into doing arenas. I mean, I always remember with X Factor, if you won it or you were in the final 10 or whatever, they used to do an arena tour,
yeah,
at the end of the year, Christmas. Now, you can't go from being in your bedroom to going on X Factor, crapping yourself doing an audition, to then in the new year standing in front of 10,000 people and performing.
Take two. How are you, Matt? How are you?
Very well, mate. Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
So, not an introduction, but just a brief couple of words for those that don't know. Who are you?
Who am I? God, that's a very good question. I am Matt Hoyt. I'm a former vocalist with Ali Campbell's UB40. Also, all-round musician, singer, done backing singing, session singing for over 30 years now. And I'm currently the lead vocalist with House of Fire.
Amazing. So we've got a bit of a slight different room today.
Yes, it's a lovely room. It's a beautiful room.
We're in the garrison. It's nice and airy. So yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on, mate.
It's a pleasure to be here, mate. Absolutely.
I mean, I feel like we already know each other.
It is a bit weird, isn't it? Well, that's a Brummie thing, though, I think, as well. Exactly. And also, it's a privilege to be, because like I said to you before, I've never actually been to the Blues Ground before. So to be in the garrison in the Blues Ground is even a double wow.
Well, beautiful romance, mate.
And that as well.
So how did you get into music?
God, I think it's how music got into me, for want of a better word. When I was young, my mum used to listen to all the old classics, you know, Engelbert Humperdinck and Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Jim Reeves, all that kind of stuff. So I was introduced to it from a very, very young age. And I also remember being at my aunt's. She had one of them huge, big, it was like a cabinet more than anything, a piece of furniture.
Big glass-fronted doors and that
one. No, it was one of the ones. It got the radio one size, and then the other side, it got an opening where they got all the albums stuck in it. And then underneath, you pulled it down, and it was the turntable, and it was... So I just used to spend hours in there putting, I mean, I probably ruined half of them, you know, because it was only three or four, but scratching them was unbelievable.
Teeth marks.
But, you know, I just loved it, you know, and that was the thing. I'd be dancing around the living room, but as soon as somebody walked in, I'd be like, and I stopped. So the love for music over time just grew and grew and grew, and I had to grow out of my shyness to do what I wanted to do, you know what I mean? So it kind of started back then, and then over the years, going through school, never really showed any signs of it, always loved music. But then after I left school, or just about as I was leaving school, I bit the bullet and just started putting adverts up in studios around Birmingham, mainly Rich Bitch, which was one in Selly Oak, which was back in the day. Yeah, just, you know, vocalist available, or I'd go in and look for people looking for a singer. But it was a case of learning the hard way, because I always thought I could sing when I was in my bedroom, and I could sing in tune. And I also thought, I can do this, do you know what I mean? But I get to about four songs when I joined a band, this is all tight, blah, 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 and they go, oh, come on, you got to do a gig. You can do a gig when you can only sing four songs.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't project, I couldn't get out there. So I was with my mum was a single parent family. She sent me to singing lessons, got a lover in Handsworth, or Lazelle's, not far from there.
Yeah.
And I went for about a year, and Jo Dwyer, she was an opera singer. And she just basically taught me how to project and breathe and relax and where to sing from. And so that was, invaluable, do you know what I mean, for the rest of my career then. And then he just carried on, just like joining bands and doing bits and bobs until I got serious with it then, professional.
So has it always been reggae or is it rock?
God,
and roll?
No. No, I didn't start performing reggae until I was with Ali and the band when in 2010, I think it was. I knew nothing of reggae music. All I knew of reggae was literally UB40 and Bob Marley. That was it. That was it, you know. And especially being from Birmingham, UB40, they're kind of, I've said this to many people, they're like the Beatles of Birmingham, do you know what I mean? So going into Digbeth and walking around and seeing Depp International and all the fancy cars that used to be parked outside, that just added, for me, then, the impetus of, I want to be a pop star, or I want to be in music of some sort to get to that level where... It was just, I don't know, the enigma of it, you know, the way it looks, because you never actually seen the guys. It was just always the cars with the UB1 or the UBRB or, you know, AC or, do you know what I mean? And it was like, fucking hell, I want a bit of that. That's me. I want a bit of that, you know. And so that literally when I joined Ali, that was when I started getting into music, and it was a whole new form of music that I was introduced to.
Meeting come together, or was there an audition for that?
Well, there should have been. I was asked by my agent at the time if I'd be interested in doing some singing with Ali Campbell. And I was like, well, yeah, because I was always looking for work. Do you know what I mean? And I went down to London for a supposed audition, and I met the MD. And I think it was me that was from Birmingham, and there was about six or seven other guys, but they were from London. So when the MD met me, he told Ali, and he said, Ali apparently said, does he sound like me? Anyway, yeah, he said, give him the job then. And that's how we went. I didn't audition or do anything.
Brilliant.
Because we're both from South Birmingham, you see. So, and he was quite right in himself, because when we started touring, once we got out there, the gel of our voices was just so tight, you know, because the accent was the same. Sometimes even when you sing, you lose your accent because you tend to sing with an American accent.
Yeah.
But not with Ali, kind of, he locked in so well. And it was a joy to do, actually. So that was my introduction with Ali. But when I did it, I got the job, and I went down to the studio in London to rehearse or get the tapes and blah, blah, blah. And I had 2 weeks, literally, to learn the stuff. And it was like a 25-song set.
Wow.
And we were going on tour. And I was like, Jesus Christ. So I just said to the guy, I said, which harmonies do you want me to take? He went, well, just do what's natural for you. Do you know what I mean? Just listen to it. Wherever you feel it going, just do that. And I was like, sad. So anyway, I went through the whole lot, brought my friend in, who was a pianist, and we kind of went through the chords. And so anyway, I got down to rehearsal, and first day, the MD comes over, he said, well, Ali's due in about 1 o'clock. This is about 11. I said, let's go and have a listen, see how you've got on. It's got the little tape player. Tape players remember. And I just went through each track and he went, no, that's wrong. No, you have to change that one. Get away with it. No, I mean, we'll have to do it. Every single one at the 25, we'll have to do it again. And Ali was due in 2 hours' time. Do you know what I mean? But bang, in London, full of professional musicians. And I'm like, So anyway, we got in there and I just managed to blag through the rehearsal. Do you know what I mean? And then 2 days later, we flew out to Germany to do a gig in Berlin in front of 8,000 people. And I was only about a quarter of the way through the set. I only knew about a quarter and I blagged the rest of you. And then from there, we flew straight to Hawaii and did the whole thing. And God love Ali, you know, even back in the day, now I was, I knew I was struggling and he knew I was struggling.
I was going to say, did he know? Did
and
know
I, at the start, he was like, hey, be all right, you'll be all right. And I got out to Hawaii and I just seen him sitting there in the sun on his own. And I just thought, I'm going to have a word with him, you know. I always remember sitting, it was like a boardwalk out over the sea. And I sat down next to him. I said, I will get you. I said, I will get all this. I promise you. He went, oh, no, you know. He said, that's what rehearsals are for. He said, don't worry about it. And then he just went from strength to strength. Because once I've got it, then I learned on the road, basically.
Yeah.
Once I've got it and I knew his voice and where I was sitting within his vocal as well. Each song that came in there kind of was relatively in the same ballpark. So it was a lot easier. But yeah, there was a lot of squeaky bum times at the world.
Well, going back to what you said, I think it's the first one we've had on this podcast that someone's actually got a job for being a brummie. Do you know what I mean?
You're not
a brummie. Spoke to Paul Jim saying, hey, the glass ceilings there, brummie classes and opportunities.
But isn't it weird since Peaky Blinders how the brummie accent has gone round the other way?
Yeah.
And everybody goes, oh, you're from Birmingham, you're Peaky Blinders. You go, yeah. Yeah. It's metal before. Oh, you're all right.
Yeah, it's gone from Dudley to all Peaky Blinders.
Yeah, it was, no, I'm not from the Black Country, I'm from Birmingham,
Essex. There's a line in that. So we had Cash the Flash on a few weeks ago, didn't we? And obviously, you know, so you lot, you know, Cash the Flash, biggest fan.
Oh, yeah.
So
we used to play football with Cash in Stratford. I mean, it was years ago. I mean, I was only young, but he used to play on the big open area next to the river.
Yep.
And he was always playing football and we always used to join and there he is, a lovely fella.
Well, he was talking about...
you wouldn't want one of them slow tackles, would you?
Oh, God.
I was shit scared of him, but he stayed well away from that business. You know? He's huge as well back in the day.
Yeah, he's still a massive.
No, I agree near that.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd still be glad, yeah.
But we were talking about the Birmingham thing and we were hoping to get Apache Indian on and stuff like that.
Oh, okay, yeah, yeah.
And speaking to Barry Tones the other week and stuff, he was saying that Liverpool shout about the Beatles and Cilla Black and so. And other cities shout about their heritage in music. Birmingham is just a hive for worldwide music, isn't
absolutely,
it?
Absolutely, yeah.
We need a bit more kind of, again, going back to the Brummie thing, which seems to be a theme, but we don't really shout about ourselves. We're like, yeah, we're all right.
No,
and that's probably
I agree.
It reminds me of what you were saying, just where he's going, I will get it.
Mm.
And like, where Cockney would be like, yeah, or kind of brash about it. Yeah. Brummies are just like, okay, yeah.
Yeah,
we'll get it. We'll work through it, and
he's taking it on the chin, isn't he, and working through it. And I agree, yeah. But like you said, Birmingham, it does downplay a lot of its talent. You know, I mean, when you think of Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and UB40, and you know that he's the wealth. I mean, especially when I was young, growing up and doing this, we used to call them spit and sawdust boozers.
Yeah,
they were part of the circuit, and there was like the Jug of Ale in Moseley, and the Breeden Bar, and the Hibernian, and the railway, which was on Curzon Street, Hare and Hounds. Mm. You kind of learnt your craft, and it was predominantly a rock city, Birmingham, back in the day, especially in Dudley and all around there as well, which isn't Birmingham, but it's like JB's and all around there. They were all rock venues. So when you now experience like the Aussies farewell concert the other day, the people that came to be a part of it, you know, and
it looked incredible.
It was just like, it was incredible. I mean, it made me laugh in a way. I mean, it was bad for them, but it did make me giggle. Is Oasis's first gig was like the same weekend in Cardiff Arms Park. And it's like, nobody give a shit because Ozzy was retiring. He's like, all them years we were going to waste, he's going to get back together. And then when it happened, he was like, boo. No, Ozzy's out.
It was the same with ALO's concert as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I was coming back from Port of Benoos, and there was a guy flying over and asking how to get to town and whatnot from the airport. So I'm just coming over for the night watching ALO, then I'm going back.
Mm.
So, oh, you're flying back. Yeah, so you're flying over from Spain.
Well, wasn't it cancelled as well? Was it
the so you've done the first one, but he had a broken hand, didn't he? But since then, he's taken ill, hasn't he? He had to cancel yesterday.
Oh, right, okay.
Or the weekend, so yeah. Phenomenal. Yeah, he's all right.
I used to know Richard Tandy, who was the keyboard player, because one of my first ever bands, when they first broke up, the manager, my manager at the time was a guy called Big Mick Hughes, his name was. He was actually a sound engineer, but he dabbled in management. And he was about 6 foot three, 6 foot four, big, long, dark head, big beard. You know, remember Giant Haystacks?
Mm.
Look, a bit like him, you know? But he was a sound engineer. He'd done Aerosmith, Guns N' Roses, and he'd been with Metallica for like 30 years. Do you know what I mean? And I've lost my train of thought now. Where was we going?
Mick Tandy.
That's right. So when I left that first band, he knew Mr. Tandy himself. And I went to his house. He was only around the corner from me. I didn't even realise he lived on Sarepol Mill. And he took me up into his studio where all his keyboards were, and he was in his loft. And it was a bit like, you know, when people are into model train sets, it was like that, but for a bloke who's into keyboards. So you walk up, it was huge, and it was like a circle, and he just got keyboards all the way around in a circle, but you could walk around the outside, and he could just get up and move to the next one. And they were all turned on. It was just unbelievable. Do you remember the wealth of history in that loft from all he'd done over the years? It was incredible, but such a lovely guy, God rest his soul. Yeah, really nice.
You know, before you, you said you were doing backing and studio session stuff. Yeah. You'd work with Wet and Boy George.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are your enduring memories from that song? Because I'm huge at that song as well, aren't I?
Yeah. I mean, the Boy George thing, that was a step in. That was, I got a call because one of the BVs had gone ill and they just said, could you jump on it? And it was, I only did a couple of gigs. And it was through a guy called John Themis. He was the MD at the time with Boy George. The Wets thing, that was a whole nother story because we were in the studio recording with the band that I was currently in. They'd fell apart, but the guy who owned the studio, it was a place called Linford Manor in Milton Keynes. And the guy who owned the studio, I can't remember his name now. He now owns the MK Dons football team. No, it's gone. But he reminded me of Rick Mayo. But he called Mick, my manager, up and said, look, the Wets have been here. They've put a couple of tracks down, but they've split up, or Marty's left them, or he's ill. Something's happened, and they've just disbanded this track. He said, but the one of them that I've heard, he said, would suit Matt down to the ground. It'd be a perfect solo track. So anyway, I went down, and he played it, and it was literally a number one. It was a pop track, the formula that they used for a pop track.
Yeah.
It was all there. And he said, come down, stay a few days. Because Linford Manor was used. I've never been to Milton Keynes. It's like they're all vertical and horizontal, right? And it all looks the same, but it's like a beautiful house, manor house, right in the middle of it in Linford. And Jamiroquai have recorded there, Skunk and Nancy. It's beautiful. So he said, come down, set up. He said, and just record it and just have a play with it. So we did that. And after we'd done that, he called Graham Clark, who was the bass player with the Wets. He said, you've got to come down. You've got to come down to the studio and listen to this. I've got Martin, who's an artist that I've known for you, and he sang one of your songs. You ain't going to believe it. You want to come down, you might want to release it. So we came down and he loved it. He was with Paul Spong, who was the trombone player with them, and Robbie Williams and all that. And they said, oh, this is going to be incredible. So it was kind of on the cards that I would have been, although he was talked about, I was going to be the new lead singer with the Wets, you see. So we said, we're going to have to do another couple more and we'll get like a formula together to get it out there. So I was like, yeah, great. He was like, fucking hell, we'll be lead singer with the Wets. Yeah. I mean, if somebody had asked me now, I'd be like, nah, no thanks, because you never replace the lead singer because you're always classed as, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's no Marty Pillow.
Exactly. Even though you could be better, miles better, but you're still classed as, you know, it's not Marty Pillow. It's the voice in it. So anyway, we did that, but unbeknownst to the band at the time, then Marty had been working on material without their knowledge, like solo stuff. So he signed a deal on his own with Mercury Records that they were signed to, and the label dropped Wet, Wet, Wet to pursue him to put his stuff out there because they couldn't have the two.
So could you have not fronted that and been Wetter, Wet, Wet, or
Wet, no. No, he just went, nah, sorry, lads. I mean, after that, I mean, the career that they had as well, at that point was like 25 years strong, you know, I mean, they just dropped him like that, you know.
Wow.
Just for the lead singer, you know. So that fell through. And then I just did loads of other stuff. I did like adverts, commercials, radio jingles, just anything I could do to get myself out there. But the first band I was ever in was a band called Joe Junk. And they've all gone on to do mega things. I mean, Carl Brazil, he was the drummer. He's now Robbie's drummer. I think Carl's got a box here as well. He's a massive blues fan. Sean, the keyboard player, he's MD for Ollie Murs and all them kind of it. So we've all gone on to do relatively well in our own little chosen areas, you know what I mean? So that's how it came about then that I got the gig with Ali. And then I just decided, instead of, because you used to chop and change with different artists because you didn't want to stay with you. Ali was the first person. I thought, like, I could get used to this. I could sit with this. And that I stayed with him for about 12, 13 years. And we just went around the world 5, 6, 7 times. Just credit.
My mate is a drummer for That Boy's Life. Will.
Right. Oh, okay. Well, Will. Yeah, I know Will.
Never.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, Will's
Will used to sit in the studio. Talking about the band that we were in. Will used to sit in the studio watching as a little lad. While we were rehearsing, that's how long I've played well here.
Wow. He phoned me the other day.
A good lad.
He was like, I'm back in Birmingham, let's get together. So, what have you been doing? So, well, obviously, I've been out with the lads and stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just come off the back of a Natalie and Brulia tour. I forgot where I was and I went, is she still fit? And then my missus just like, she went, yeah, you definitely not there. You said you have to come to one of the gigs once. And she's
like, I think you're going anyway now.
Exactly, yeah. Ruined it for myself. Oh, but no, yes. he says the same that it's, you could get a call. Because you know in the industry, you could get a call one week and go, are you fixed?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think we've been with Ali as well, because I was with him for so long, that stopped as well, because so there's no point calling Matt. He's been with Ali now for 4 or 5 years. He's just, that's what he's doing. So all that, for me, that side of the industry completely stopped when I was with Ali. So there's kind of no way back into it either. Do you know what I mean? Especially because coming out of it now in 2021, I mean, I'm 51 now. I'm going to go back into the pop scene. Do you know what I mean? I'm too old. So doing the stuff that we're doing now, especially as I'm a writer as well, it's just a pleasure to be with the boys that I'm around now, because I'm still the baby in the band as well. They're all like, well, fuckers, you know what I mean?
It's like going from open age to 35.
What'd you say, granddad? You know, it's great. So, yeah.
I know it's well documented anyway, and you've done interviews and stuff in the past, but can we talk about leaving the band then?
Yeah.
How that played out. I mean, talked about the great memories of touring the world seven times.
Yeah.
So how did that play out, leaving?
It was, I'll tell you how we started. We were in Puerto Rico and there was all the news of all this COVID thing that was going to happen. And when you're on tour for so long, it's like the boys in the band, they're like your second family. Do you know what I mean? You're home from home. So we were all talking about going, it's never going to happen. We've heard all these kind of shit things before. It's never happened. Lo and behold, we got back and we were thrown into lockdown, blah, blah, blah. And that went on forever. And the thing is, when you're a touring musician, it's like the first thing you want to do when you get home is kind of go into your own lockdown, because you've been away from home for so long. You don't want to go out. You don't want to go to the pub. You just want to stay in your own house, watch Netflix, eat shit and do it. But there comes a time after about, I don't know, say 2 or 3 weeks, you kind of get itchy feet again. You know, you don't need to get back out there. So that's what kind of got you through. So when we went into lockdown, it just kept going on forever and ever. For me, the light at the end of the tunnel was getting back out on the road, and it just never arrived. But it was the one thing, even with my mental health at the time, that it kept me going forward, you know. So when it was kind of due that the management had got the call to say that venues were opening up again and certain venues were going to allow live music and blah, blah, blah. The management there, but you need to have this COVID jab thing that's going around. I mean, don't get me wrong. At that point, I was anti-vax at all. I'd had vaccines, yellow fever, all that kind of stuff, because we'd been to places you wouldn't even know, you know, mid-Africa and down in the South Pacific and all those kind of places. So I was never shy to a vaccine. And now I look back on it, I was always ill after I'd had a vaccine. But you just don't think, you just think it's part of the course, you know. But this, when it came out, when the management said, no, he said, you venues and insurance companies, which was a load of shit, I didn't realize that was a lie, have stipulated that you must have the COVID vax so you can go out and play live. And there was no question about it. And I was like, nah. It's just this fax is just too convenient. It's just come up within the, you know, a year.
That came out.
It was ridiculous. You know, vaccines are like researched for like up to 25 years, you know what I mean? I was like, nah. Or every red flag was waving. All the alarms were going off. I was like, nah. So I let it go and I let it go. And in the end, the manager was sending me all this, Matt, we need an answer. So my missus said to me, she said, you're going to need to get this in writing. So she said, send them a message and just say, look, I take it, unless I have this vaccine, I'm no longer permitted to be a part of or perform with the band anymore. And they just sent a text back going, yeah, that's right. After 12 years, do you know what I mean? There was no phone call, no nothing. That 12 years, I missed one gig in 12 years.
And I suppose these are like your mates to a certain extent, are they or not?
Well, the management are never your mates. The management, especially Ali's management, they were always a bit...
You're not out for beers with them after?
No, not really.
It's not that kind of...
Not really. And over time, there'd been friction over the last couple of years regarding... money again, UB40, ironically, within the band and the artists, that we weren't getting our dues because we kind of felt we'd been duped a little bit at the beginning of it all, because Ali left the original lineup, and we kind of agreed on a fee to get him back on his feet again. And then once he'd achieved that certain notoriety that he was back out without the others, but he was with his new band and we were doing bigger venues like the arenas, that he would sort of say, like, he'd return the favour. And it never happened. He never sorted his band out, basically. So we were kind of, we were like over a barrel because, like I said to you before, because we've been with him for so long, we weren't getting any calls anymore. It weren't just me, it was the rest of the band. People weren't calling us because, oh, they've been out on the road with Ali for 5-6 years. We ain't going to bother calling.
Yeah.
So we had to stay with him to earn a living. And he knew that. So we got us over a barrel. So towards the end of it, I'd say, after being in there for about 10 years, I was starting to get a bit tetchy with it all because I'm the type of person, I have to say how I feel. I've always been that way. And I was kind of dropping remarks and saying, look, you know, we need a pay rise. This is ridiculous what we're on there. Function band, wedding singers are going out for the same money that you're paying us. Like that, yeah. And we're doing O2 in London, you know what I mean, in front of 15,000 people. And the band were all in agreement as well. They're like, yeah, no, we've got to do this. You know what I mean? I said, all we need to do, I said, it's not blackmailing. We just, before a show, when all the audience is in there, say with the O2, for example, we just say to him, look, this is what we want. This is what we want the wage to go up to. It's on paper there. Can you sign it and agree to it? And then we'll go on and do the gig. Until you do that, we ain't going on. And he's going to feel pressurized into the fact that there's 15,000 people waiting for him out there, but his band ain't going to go on unless he sorts him out and pays him the proper wage. So that was that. And it was, you know, it was never going to come to any fruition. So the thing for me, I think they wanted me out as well because I was causing friction within the band as well. And I think that the jab thing, even though I didn't agree with it and I never would have had it, it was just another excuse to give me the final push out the door. Do you know what I mean? But it was, you know, this, as I say, everything happens for the reason, so.
It's naughty, isn't it?
But it is, because I don't think much has changed since, yeah, do you know what I mean?
What's still in there. Come out now is that it's a load of shit, isn't
exactly,
it?
Yeah.
He had about 5 different variants every other week. He's had COVID-19, COVID-20, COVID-21.
I didn't think he's had 22 now. I didn't have any of them, but then that stopped me from, so a couple of years ago, I was going to go to Marbs with these, with the blues.
Mm.
It would have been a great business opportunity, obviously on the lash and playing golf.
But yeah.
It would have been great. And they were like, and obviously the country was like, you can't go to not jab. Then I was very close then. Yeah. To being like, all right, let's do it. But yeah. I just lasted this long. But like you said, I had like so many variants of it. It's like tapas.
Yeah, but of course, yeah.
But it's, I thought, I'm all right, I'm still
young. Yeah, I would have heart failure, I think.
No.
The thing is, it's like the one main thing, I mean, all the stuff that I did surrounding it, I mean, I've done many interviews now, and I always call it my Starbucks moment, was the fact that when, I mean, I'll be perfectly honest with you, when it first happened, you know, with the masks and all that kind of stuff, I wore a mask for about a week, and because I went into Starbucks with the wife, and we're all wearing masks, everybody's wearing masks, you know, got a coffee, sat down, and everybody was taking them off. I was like, what's going on here? So I took my mask off to have a coffee, and we got about another hour to kill, so I said to him, he said, do you want another coffee? So she had gone there. So I've gone up to get another. She went, I'll put your mask back on. I'm like, you are. So I've been sat in here for about 40 minutes having a coffee with anyone. Why have I got to put it on to go? And it was that then. I just thought the penny just dropped. And I'm like, oh, this is bollocks, you know. Yeah. And also the fact that they haven't isolated COVID as a virus either. It's not
bothering anymore, are they?
No. And everybody at the beginning of it go, oh, the vaccines they call is causing heart problems, myocardial, pericardial. He was, oh, you're stupid. You're, don't be fucking idiot. You know, it's now come out, the FDA ruling that they're putting it on all the packaging and all the injections that it's causing heart problems. So, you know,
success rate is not where what was first reported, is it? Because that's nowhere near the efficacy of.
No. It's just
a lot past it.
So, but that's that. It's all, I mean, I've been doing it for 5 years now, all that kind of stuff. I've been marching for the truth to wake people up. And I think I've put me shift in, if you know what I mean.
So you can fall that off now. How far did you go with it, though?
And,
well, just goes, doesn't it? Levels.
But they always say that. I think people are saying he's bonkers, and they, because he's been going on about this for ages and ages.
Yeah.
And you get castigated, and him to a certain extent being castigated, because you've never seen him anything else. But then. Other people,
all of a sudden, he's not on Sky Sports Soccer Saturday, is he? And
but the problem you have is, though, when you get embroiled in it and you realise the fraud behind it, it gets you so mad and angry, and you think, you bastards. And then what it's done, it's opened Pandora's box. So it's not just COVID now. So you're looking into things like council tax and going, hang on, I'm going to look into council tax. And you go, holy shit. And then you go back a bit further. I didn't realise you didn't have to pay council tax. Everybody said, yeah, you got to pay it. We go to court. Mm. No, you don't.
TV licensing.
You don't have to pay that.
Mm.
It's all the same thing. You know, council tax, they threaten you with liability orders. You know, there hasn't been a liability order from council tax since 2003. They abolished them. So they threaten everybody with a liability order, but they don't even exist. So you go, oh, that's fraudulent. And you wonder what else we got? TV license. Jesus Christ, I'm paying that. Then you'll get energy companies. Therefore, you go into that. Do you know what I mean? It's like you avalanche yourself
into a ball of lava in your house, can't you? Just
so for your own mental health, you have to just go, do you know what? Stop now. I mean, I'm going to carry on doing my own personal stuff, but you have to have a breathe because I'd go absolutely
bonkers. I think something in your brain just a flick and you don't. But they try and make out of you David Icke, don't they then?
This is the problem.
A lot of people are lizards and all that. Like, I'm not talking about that. We're talking about this, but the people who have
absolutely
followers and the voices can kind of make or break your sense. It's just the media, isn't it?
And with the internet, there's never been a time in history where you've had so much access to so much information, is there? Like with the PTE scandal and all that.
Yeah.
You should never have known about that.
No.
And then all of it, like, what it's found for me is the politicians aren't as clever doing what they think they can get away with as they used to be.
That's right.
Because the internet now is going, look what he's doing. Look what I've done.
But that's what... We're talking about Pandora's box and going back to that. That's where the internet is a double-edged sword for them guys, because without it, previous years, they got away with so much because they manipulated everything. They owned everything. They owned the TV, the cinemas, the magazines, the newspapers, the radio, everything. You heard what they wanted you to hear. Bingo. So now you've got the internet. They forgot that there's people like us that go, 2 seconds, minute. Actually, that's not right what you've just said there. And they go into it and research. So everything they've tried to put out, that's why you've had so many variants of COVID, because they're trying to put another one out to scare people. But people go, oh, bollocks.
Same as one. Yeah.
And they keep getting monkeypox, skunkpox, fucking, you know, elephantpox, whatever. Do you know what I mean? It's like, well, how many are you going to throw out there? You're just hoping that somebody's going to believe one of them, you know?
Yeah.
And that's how it's counterbalanced then, you know what I mean? So, but it is what it is.
It is.
Where are we at the moment?
With COVID?
No, you're going through with, I know,
you're allowed to talk, sore throat, but
yeah, you're allowed to talk about where the battle that you've had with the band and stuff. Has that been sorted or is that?
No, it's just, I think the thing is, at the time I was angry and I'm sure they were angry with me because I went out there and I was slagging them off and they were slagging me off. But that was 5 years ago. Do you know what I mean? And you have to move on. Otherwise, like we were talking about this, now you go bonkers. It, for me, looking back on it and reflecting on it, it was an experience that changed my life forever within music. I've been around the world, God knows how many times. I've been to countries I didn't even know existed. I've experienced cultures I didn't even know existed. I've toured America about 5 or 6 times on a tour bus from east to west, you know, north to south, South America, Africa, Asia, South Pacific, New Zealand, Australia. I've been everywhere. Do you know what I mean? So when you have to pull out the positives of a situation, yeah, that was shit. You didn't pay me enough. Yeah, it was shit about the COVID facts, but it's life. Yeah. You know what I mean? Move on. Otherwise, you just sit there going, So I moved on, and I'm at the minute, I'm in such a good place because I've kind of put things to rest a little bit regarding all the awake stuff and the truth stuff, and I've come back to what I should be doing, which is being a musician and a singer and a songwriter. And I'm having the time of my life at the minute, you know, especially being back in that environment with the boys. It's like the banter, you know what I mean? Because being in a band, it's just pure banter.
It shows that on your socials. Just that you're just having a good time.
Yeah, it really is.
Don't take each other too seriously.
Yeah. Not at all. You know, and that's how it should be, because we want that to reflect into the music then as well, because that's what reggae music is about, being free and just enjoying yourself, you know? Yeah.
So tell us about that then. House of Fire.
House of Fire, God. It's a bit
naughty. Who came up with the name?
I come up with a name, but it's a bit naughty how it was put together. It's actually, the name is a cross translation of two of my favorite reggae bands, because there's a band in New Zealand called House of Shem, and there's a band from Jamaica called Raging Fire. So mix the two together and called it House of Fire. But yeah, the way it was put together was with, there's a guy, a mutual friend of mine, and Tony Mullins, if anybody doesn't know, who's the keyboard player with the original lineup of UB40, the arch enemy of my UB40 when I was with Alan. So there's a guy who was in the middle. I won't name his name because in case he doesn't want any of the bad press, but he set up a secret meeting in his studios in Birmingham. And he just said, mate, he said, I ain't seen you for ages. You come down the studio. He said, I've got a few people around. He said, oh, you know, it might be worth your meeting, blah, blah, blah. And he did exactly the same with Tony. He said, come down. He said, I ain't seen you for ages. You know, so anyway, he said, 7 o'clock, I walked in at, because I'm late for everything, as you very well know. I've walked in at 7:10, and Tony Mullins is standing there. I've gone, get the fuck out of here. What's going on here? And he looked at me and went, all right, mate, what's going on? And I thought, what's here? And he just...
And the guy in the middle was like,
That's what he was like. Shut the door, locked it behind. And he was like, let's go and have a chat. And we just turned out that me and Tony got on like a freaking house on fire. We knew of each other, but never met. Right. Do you know what I mean? But we were mutual friends with the guy in the middle. So we just sat down, we had a Guinness each, and we just started chin-wagging, talking about music, talking about reggae, touring, each side of the band, and, you know, different stories. And like a person A, I'll call it, he just said, you know, you should put something together. Can you imagine? When they find out that you've come together, and they'd be fucking happy. And we did it initially, not for the fact of the music we could produce. We did it going, yeah, let's be guns and bear and just do it. You know what I mean? Tony was like, yeah, let's do it. So that's how we started. And then we got Steve involved. Excuse me. Steve's the drummer and producer. And then Dennis Jarrett, he's a keyboard player, producer, writer. And the wealth of artists they've all worked with together as well. Steve and Ted, Dennis, you know what I mean? Dennis has worked with Sugar Minart and Michael Rose. Steve's worked with Beanie Man, Vibes Cartel. He's musical director with Musical Youth. You know, it's just a wealth of reggae, you know, royalty, you know. And we've just been in the studio for the last, I'd say, 9 months with no pressure. Just we'd start a track and we'd do a bit of it and then maybe go on to something else and we'll come back to that. And that's how it's been, really nice. You know what I mean? But the reason we released Help Me Make It Through the Night first was because everybody knows it. It's one of them old classics. But during the end of my period with Ali, we did a gig that was me, Ali and Astro. God rest his soul. Love Astro. He'd be over the moon with his Bjorn.
Yeah.
But we did a gig in Holland with John Holt and Luciana, and it was with the Royal Symphony Orchestra. And it was mind-blowing. We were literally out in the countryside with the symphony orchestra. And we did about 4 or 5 songs, UB40 songs, with the orchestra playing behind us here, with a conductor. And I'm going to digress now because it's a really funny story, but we're out there. And the marquees that were set up for dressing rooms, they were miles away, do you know what I mean? And they had them golf carts. But there was a miscommunication between the stage and our tour manager at the time as to what time we were due on. So what happened was like 10, 15 minutes before we were due on, the golf cart come and take us to the backside. We put all our packs and our ears in and blah, blah, blah. We'd be ready to go. So as soon as we're introduced, off we go. So anyway, we're in the dressing room. And I'm just putting my shoe on, you know, and I'm making sure Ali's fucking just putting his jacket on. He's put his sunglasses on, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah, no, Clarty. Did he? He did, yeah. We were, the grass was this high. And there's the tour manager, Ali, me, and Astro going, going through all this like hay and long grass marching tour, and he was baking up to march through. And all you can hear in the background is, and the audience is coming mental. But you can hear the, because we're so far away, you can hear the audience slowly getting quieter and quieter. So, are they taking the piss or what?
The intro,
the intro was about 20 minutes long. You know, they thought we were being divas then as well. Like, oh, you know? But it was so funny. Oh, mate, we walked on it. Literally, people going,
like, no, no, no.
But it was epic. So where were we now? After I digressed, what were we talking about?
The orchestra.
John Holt. John Holt. So the next day, and let me tell you, John Holt had got 2 weeks left to live after that gig. And we didn't obviously know at the time. But he was very frail. He was being guided around by his grandson everywhere. But as soon as he sat down and sang, it was like he was 21 again. You know, the voice was exactly the same. And he was just like, Jesus Christ. But he was in breakfast in the hotel in the morning, and he came down and he sat at the table behind me. And I just started talking to him, and I was talking to his grandson. I said, Jonathan, I'm going to do one of your songs on my album when I do a solo album. And he went, yes, I said, you do one of mine. And I was like, I've got to do it, man. You know, I've had the consent of John Holt himself, you know. And I never did it. And I was fuming with myself. So that's the reason we did the first track, you know, of John Holt, because I thought, I've got to do it at some point and do it justice, you know what I mean? And there was nobody better than the guys I'm with now to do it in that old school. Yeah, what? Because they've been there, you know, isn't
it?
Yeah. So everybody's saying, obviously, it'll never be as good as the original, but it's close enough. Yeah. So, yeah, so that's the way we do it. But the stuff, the original stuff we've been putting together as well, it's some of the best stuff I've ever been involved with in my whole of my nearly 30-odd year career. It's just incredible.
Just going back to like shits there and banter and for shits and giggles and all that.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Couldn't you like turn clutch like WWF and join? Was there any chance that you could join
the other year before? Yeah. Oh God, no, because they hated me as well. I was like that one person that both bands fucking hated me for. What the fuck, I fucking
that,
met you?
That night we got uniforms
together. Yeah. And I think it was due for the vaccines, because they were all ripping, you know, they're going, well, you can't fucking sing anyway. So, well, I can. Don't be a tosser. You know, just keep to the subject.
Wow.
You know, so I can't sing. I've done this career for like 30 years. Of course I can sing.
It's rubbish anyway.
Yeah, you know, shit. That's what he was like. It was like kid stuff, you know. Yeah, he's shit anyway. You can't sing. You think of the earning crap. So anyway, there was that. And then he was also like, well, I don't know what he's doing anyway. He said, you've got to have the vaccine to go on tour anyway. You know, everybody knows that. And he was just like, well, no, you ain't actually. You know, I'm going to stick to my guns, and I'm not going to go on tour. And when I see people dropping like flies, I told you he shouldn't have had it.
Yeah.
But that's what it was like. So that's why they hated me. And the other band, I mean, like you said, it's like your second family. You know what I mean? And we were really close, all of us. Not one call did I get after I got fired. Not one from any of them. You know, one person, that was Pops, who was the guitarist, but I mean, even with Pops, he was heartbreaking, because just before I left, he was about 74, 75, Pops. So it's Winston DeLandro was his real name, but he was like my tour dad, you know what I mean? And he played with Bob Marley, Johnny Nash. He was a legend himself. He was a little bit forgetful, but it was his age. Nothing you worry about. You just kind of related to being that age. Always forgot his thing again, you know. And he'd go, oh, fuck, old Sam, you know, he proper cockney, you know what I mean? But after he'd had this thing in his arm, Drifter, who's an American tour manager we used to use all the time, he phoned me up. He said, I don't know, I can't even recognise him. He said, he's in the dressing room. He's left his guitar by the stage, and he keeps going back and forth because he keeps forgetting that he's left it by the stage. And it just accelerated his dementia within 3 to 4 months after having the jab. And it was just heartbreaking. There's other people in the band, the things, I mean, it's been documented what I've said about all the members, and I'm not going to go down that road anymore because it's not fair on them. I spoke about it. If you want it out there, you can go and find it. And respect to them and their family and everything, which is fair enough. I was angry back then, and I apologize if I offended them back then, but I was angry. But it was, we was just seeing the effects of it. Do you know what I mean? And it was really sad and wrong. But yeah, the banter within a band, you gotta have that. But there was no way I was going to there.
The other side.
They'd be with Swords at Dawn, you know what I mean? Jesus Christ. So that's the reason why we Tony in the band there. We both getting the stories from the other side, and there's nothing that can do about it either. Yeah. So yeah, you know. I mean, and also the thing with Tony left that lineup because of a situation with Mr. Campbell himself as well. You know what I mean? So, and I won't say because that's Tony to talk about, but you know, it's the
like just, everything happens for a reason, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
It's just going on. So what you're doing now, you're flat out, and a lot of the festivals and does it give you a, no pun intended, fire in your stomach then to be like, well, we're going to be better.
That was a good pun.
As I was saying it, I thought. To be like, it's Africa, man. Let's make it even more so. You're probably ambitious before.
I think it changes from ambition to doing, because I wouldn't know what else to do as a job anyway. After doing it for so long, if I was something else, God, I don't know. I think probably a taxi driver, because I'm not going to drive. I'll be shit at that as well. I don't know what I would do. I've never done anything other than music, and the thought of not doing it fills me with dread. You know what I mean? Mm. So I think it's not so much ambition that's drive. It's kind of doing something that we all know so well. And are comfortable doing, and are in a position where we're happy and enjoying it as well together in the company that we're with at the minute.
And that's what you got to find now, isn't it? Especially in the later stages of a career, you've got to be happy, haven't you?
Well, it's like being in a relationship, like a marriage. If you're in a marriage that's constantly abusive or you're raving all the time, it's like, I can't be arsed with this, you know what I mean? And then you get something, you know, that's good and just smooth and easy going. This is where I'm enjoying it, and this is where I want to stay now, you know? And the same, I think the rest of the boys in the band will agree with that as well.
Yeah.
That's what COVID did for a time, wasn't it? Afterwards, when you were allowed back out, kind of made the focus on what is important. Oh. And it's not chasing rat race a million miles an hour, is it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So what would, before that, what's your favourite three songs for? What's your top three?
Ever.
Oh, wet, Boy George and everything. Oh,
God.
That's a good one. I like that.
The one I did with Boy George, Victims, that blew my mind when I saw you perform that live. Do you remember Victims?
Yeah, I've seen it.
The victims we know so well, and this light in your eyes. There's a bit at the end of it where he just stops, and then the drums go, doom, 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 doom. Dude, and it goes massive big re-entry basically.
Yeah.
For want of a better word.
No pun intended.
But it was because he was in the arena, do you know what I mean? And all the flames went off and all the lights went up and it just blew me away. I haven't really got Red Red Wine was always one. Not so much for the song, because I don't really like it actually, but it was the audience reaction. As soon as Ali went, the whole place. And also, Maybe Tomorrow. When we used to do that in New Zealand, all the Maoris joined in and he said, he'd go, da 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 it was incredible. So that those would have been, yeah, I think one of the three that were memorable anyway. That's the best I could do on the
spot. You just did.
Do you know, just give me a little fun. Do you know when you were going back in singing, did you ever have to choreograph with the, all black?
No, that's
scared
shit. They scared the shit out of me, the Marys, when I first met them. I mean, some of them are my best friends in the world now. I mean, because they dropped, I mean, I'm covered in all the Mary stuff. But they are if I didn't live in the UK, I would be in New Zealand. They are the nicest, kindest, loyalist people you will ever meet in your life. And that's when we're talking about, you know, experiencing different cultures. That for me, and Hawaii as well, because it's very similar. It's like a Polynesian South Pacific vibe, you know. But I think the thing with on stage with that, you just did the left and the right. That was it the whole way through. And then we did Can't Help Falling in Love, and I'll come to that. I'll get the audience doing the wave. So when you got a wave, a sea of arms doing that, you know, it's memorable. But it's what's really cool about it is the fact that when you're on stage and it's set up, it's like your living room. So it's all, everything is always in the same place. So one day you stood and you're overlooking the ocean with people in front. The next day you're overlooking mountains. The next day you but the stage is exactly the same. So it's like, reassuring in a way, you know what I mean? So, but yeah, memorable times. I mean, times I'll be forever thankful for, you know what I mean?
So what advice would you give to a young man or lady?
Don't do it.
Don't do what?
Don't do any of it.
Don't ever get involved in music if you love it. Go on, I'll let you finish the question because I might go off on a tangent. I don't know.
No, that's it. What advice would you give to a young person looking to...
A young drummer.
Loves music, wants to be in music.
I think the key word, if you want to be successful in music, is tenacity. Because it's got nothing to do with talent. Obviously, you've got to have a certain level of it. But it's all luck. It's all luck at the end of the day. And what comes with tenacity is the fact that you have to put yourself in the right place at the right time and be prepared to be the one that gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 o'clock or doesn't finish till 2 and 3 in the morning and has to be up after 2 hours. To get that job, to work that hard, to lose your voice and then see that the person that's hiring you sees how hard you're working and go, well, I'll let you have a day off so we can come back and try it again. It's all that. You can't. Nowadays, the music industry, with all, I think X Factor and all those kind of things absolutely obliterated the industry because you just get people who can stand in the bedroom and sing with an airbrush in front of the mirror and think they're world famous. And then they go on there, and because they can slightly sing in tune, they're accelerated into doing arenas. I mean, I always remember with X Factor, if you won it or you were in the final 10 or whatever, they used to do an arena tour at the end of the year, Christmas. Now, you can't go from being in your bedroom to going on X Factor, crapping yourself doing an audition, to then in the new year, standing in front of 10,000 people and performing. Doesn't matter who you are. It's what I always remember Astro saying. With a stage that big in an arena, it's like an apprenticeship. You have to work your way up to that and learn how to use that stage. You know, the stage isn't the size it is just because you've got more equipment. It's because you've got more popular and you learn how to use every single inch of it. Like you would a car or an F1 driver, you know every single angle of that car. And it's like being a performer. So you can't go from X Factor to knowing how to entertain somebody at the NEC Arena. It just ain't going to happen. And I feel sorry for them.
I was going to say, I just think like the production companies, Simon Cowell's and the companies involved in this, if they got blood on their hands... To a degree, because there's loads of the young lads weren't that come out in the coke addicts. That Matt Carter was it ended up in rehab as well, didn't they?
Yeah.
Where they just take them and just feed them to the wolves and then leave Payne tragically.
Yeah, awful. Years absolutely on. Awful. But the thing is, they're accelerated into the industry, but they're also accelerated into fame. And fame is, it's not what people think it is. You know, they think they know what it is. They want the adulation and they want what. But it's absolutely nothing like people think it is. I mean, I wouldn't really class myself as ever being famous. I'm well known through being in the band and to a certain set of people that follow reggae music and blah, blah, blah. But when you're accelerating, you're on the front page of the Sun every day and or you've done this or you've been to a club and you get caught doing a little toot or blah, it changes people's lives. And then for it to all of a sudden go, finish. That person's like, what do I do now then? Because everybody knows them. He can't exactly go and get a job in Tesco's now because everybody's taking the piss out of him.
Mm.
It's like it changes people's lives and it ruins people's lives. And people like X Factor, from what I watched, they didn't give a shit. It was like next year, new round of contestants. And it was just like a money-making machine. And
viable.
To be in the industry full-time, you have to go back to the old days. Like when you before we started, you know, they grafted. They did the spit and sawdust pubs. They did all the boozers, they're up and down the motorway to London and Manchester doing. And then they got people involved from record companies, spotters that come A&R people and go, yeah, we go. I mean, luckily for you, but Borty, I think they were spotted by Chrissy Hynde in Covent Garden and she asked them to go on tour with them. So that was lucky. But a lot of the other bands, they're up and down the M42, the M6, doing gigs, coming home at 3 in the morning and then doing a day job. That's the hard work.
You've got to be in those places to make that look. So someone,
you got to work hard at it, you know what I mean? And then you'll get, hopefully, that bit of luck that leads to something.
Mm.
You know, it's still luck now for us. Excuse me. We didn't know with House of Fire, hey, look who we were going to be with the first single going that well. We were just like, well, what if people don't give a shit about the fact that we're in other UB40s and people don't remember us, or that it's all relevant, you know what I mean? It's literally just look. And we're lucky that people are voting for us. Mm. They might not.
Mm.
They might think the next thing was shit, you know? So, same with anything.
But Campbell's well. Assumptions.
Yeah, that's Matt better. Hoy, he is shit. Him himself is just shit.
Both of
Matt Hoy is shit. Matt Hoy is shit.
He is shit.
Christmas symbol. Yeah. Put some bowels in the back.
Well, I've done one about sausage rolls. I'm not doing about me being shit, you know?
Mate, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, mate, thank you for inviting me down.
Yeah, I hope it goes well.
Thank you very much.
And I feel like I'm going to come watch.
Well, I'll bring the boys with me next time. Yeah, we'll have a proper tune, Mogan, and then you'll get some real banter then.
Thank you, mate.
Pleasure.
Cheers. Cheers. Pleasure.